You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm Jeet here of The Nation magazine. The podcast is sponsored by The Nation magazine as well, and is widely available on podcasting platforms and some radio stations. This week, you know, the monster at the gate, now as it has been for many years, is war. And war in the Middle East, and Donald Trump's very flaky foreign policy, which has gone all over the place in a matter of just a few weeks, from trying to push for a ceasefire and pushing back against some of the desires of Benjamin Netanyahu in terms of Syria and negotiating with Hamas, and then suddenly flipping to going all in with Benjamin Netanyahu and giving Israel the long desired wish to bomb Iran. And but then followed by this so-called 12-day war, followed by a ceasefire where Trump has gone back to kind of blaming both Israel and Iran, but particularly Israel, for not abiding by the ceasefire and for wanting to fight so much that they've forgotten what they're fighting for. So how to make sense of all this chaos? And one interesting thing is that it's caused disruption in the sort of political alliances within the United States, that on both the pro-war and anti-war side, you have different factions that are kind of switching gears depending on the will of the wisp, or which flaky direction Trump decides to take the American ship of state in. To talk about all this, I'm very happy to have on frequent guest of the program, David Kleon, who's a fellow columnist at The Nation, and who in particular wrote about how some never-Trump neocons have suddenly discovered they aren't so never-Trump anymore, that when it comes to bombing Iranians, suddenly they think that this would-be dictator, he has some good sides. So David, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Always great to be here. And I'll just situate us chronologically since events move quickly. We're recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, June 24th. It's incidentally primary day here in New York City where I live, and I'm, you know, fingers crossed for Zoran Mamdani, who The Nation has endorsed rightly for mayor. It could be an exciting day, or perhaps a heartbreaking one if Andrew Cuomo pulls it out. But there are some, I would say, the specter of Israel and Mideast policy does loom over this, as it does many New York City elections, but maybe especially this one, with Zoran, you know, being incredibly a candidate who will say the phrase "globalize the intifada." Anyway, by the time you're watching this, you'll likely know how this turned out, but we don't.
Well, I mean, obviously events are in flux, and I fully expect between our recording this and listeners downloading it on their pod, their laptops, that Donald Trump will have flip-flopped a few more times. But I think that maybe the best way, you know, in light of this flux situation, is to maybe think a little bit historically and to situate, you know, like what I think are the two big structural patterns. One of which is that we have this incredibly flaky man who's president, who basically seems to do policy depending on the last person he talked to, whoever flatters him most, or the dopamine hit he can get from watching Fox News. And then you have like these shifting currents in American politics where there's fractures on both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party between pro and anti-war factions. And people will align with Trump, basically depending on what he's doing that particular day. And I think that neocons in particular are a very interesting example of this, because they were welcomed into the Democratic coalition as the sort of prodigal sons who have returned back home, under the idea that, you know, like they were so disgusted with Trump that they've become Democrats again. And that has turned out not quite to be so simple.
Right. So the neocons themselves, you know, are divided in a few different ways. I mean, to the extent that we can still speak of them as a coherent group, which is always an important caveat with the neocons, as you and I both know, writing about them these days. But with the neocons in the piece in my latest Nation column, I pointed out that, you know, you have some neocons like John Podhoretz or his father, Norman Podhoretz, who, you know, Norman is explicitly pro-Trump and has endorsed him in multiple elections now. And John has been a little cagier about it, but I would say is clearly anti-Democrat, anti-left, and unambiguously happy about Trump bombing Iran. But then you also have the neocons who I think have been quite sincerely never Trump for almost a decade now, notably Bill Kristol, also, though he hadn't written his piece about it yet, but he had tweeted about it a little, David Frum. I think these guys, I think we can take them at their word that they generally do oppose Trump on most fronts and think he's an authoritarian threat. But they were very happy to see him bombing Iran, although I should be fair and say with the caveat that both of them acknowledge that, you know, they wish it was someone else doing it. They don't have a lot of faith in Donald Trump to do it right. What's ironic, and we'll get into more detail about this later, is it's conceivably possible Donald Trump actually did do it right, or at least as right as it could have been done if we'd stipulate that you're going to bomb Iran and try to, you know, I mean, we can get into that later, but but in any case, the position that Kristol and Frum seem to have carved out is we don't like Trump, we don't trust Trump, but we wish him well on this particular assignment. The most interesting piece to come out of this neocon cohort, which came out the day after my article in The Atlantic, was by Robert Kagan. And Robert Kagan is, was one of the more prominent neoconservative intellectuals in the Bush era, in the kind of in the 90s and aughts. He and Bill Kristol were instrumental in making the case for the war in Iraq. He has been a particularly outspoken and I would say cogent anti-Trump commentator for the last almost decade. The reason he's writing at The Atlantic actually is because he, along with a lot of other people, left the Washington Post editorial board after Jeff Bezos, the owner there, suppressed a presidential endorsement, which would have been an endorsement of Kamala Harris last fall. That's how anti-Trump he is. And so he ended up at Jeff Goldberg's Atlantic. And in The Atlantic, he wrote a really interesting piece, if you followed the career of Robert Kagan, basically saying that war in Iran will be a disaster. At the end, he says, I'm paraphrasing a little, but basically, not that it really matters, but count me out. And I, as a tracker of these people, I'm fascinated by what is he getting at with that. Not that it really matters, I think, is him implying, look, I'm just a columnist now. I'm not, you know, a Svengali who controls the White House to whatever extent anyone thought I was back in the Bush era or, you know, whatever. Like, I think he once criticized Obama during the Obama administration and was invited to dinner. I think I'm getting that right. By Obama. So he was considered a serious good faith critic by the president himself. Today, he seems to be saying, look, I'm just an Atlantic columnist. I'm just one guy. But for what it's worth, you know, I mean, he didn't mention anyone specifically, but I took it to mean, unlike my close friend Bill Kristol, who I've been aligned with on most things for decades now, I don't think this is a good idea. I thought he was kind of gently upbraiding Crystal a little bit.
Maybe
others.
Well, too. I think that's a good reading of it, but I actually want to emphasize as well one particular argument that he made, which I think is very cogent, and maybe sort of contextualize these guys a little bit. It's always struck me that, you know, even when I was in deep disagreement with his arguments during the second Bush administration and the Iraq war, that Robert Kagan of this cohort was a serious thinker and a serious intellectual, and was the guy who was like kind of like, you know, like really it's comparable, I think, to in an earlier generation, someone like Francis Fukuyama, you know, like someone who's like really trying to take the broad picture of where America stands in the world and make the most cogent possible case for American global hegemony as a force for good, as a historical necessity. Whereas, you know, like, you know, both Bill Kristol and David Frum have written interesting things, things I read, you know, like I pay attention to what these guys are saying, but these guys are really sort of like publicists. They're columnists. They're like out there in the public fray. They're not quite like as deep as I think Robert Kagan has been in his best writing. And as a kind of deep thinker, and Fukuyama is very similar in this way, Kagan's actually trying to think through what is the crisis of the system that has led to Trump. And also thinking about the fact that what does it mean that we have this guy who's an authoritarian threat, who's president, and then he takes us into war. What will happen in a wartime situation with a guy like Trump? And that this itself would be a massive danger to American democracy, because, you know, history has shown us that even under like fairly, you know, like otherwise admirable presidents like FDR and Abraham Lincoln, when you go to war, the entire nation becomes much more authoritarian, and the enormous power of the state can be used in repressive ways. And Kagan, you know, being a serious person, takes that seriously. Whereas I don't think, in with both Kristol and Frum, I do think that they're taking their, like, you know, longstanding anti-Iran instincts and foreign policy preferences and letting that override, you know, like an actual thinking through of this historical moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Kagan's point about the way that war is used by imperialism, that imperialist wars are used to like bolster authoritarian governments, is one that any, you know, leftist or liberal critic could recognize, and is impressive to see coming from him and coming from Jeffrey Goldberg's Atlantic. The irony here, and, you know, with our, you know, stipulations from earlier about we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow or, you know, a week from now. But as of right now, when we're recording, it seems possible that some of the Sturm und Drang around this particular war may have been a bit much. And this is not the first time this has happened. I mean, you and I both have anti-war restrainer instincts generally, although we have, I think, had some disagreements over U.S. support for Ukraine, which incidentally Robert Kagan's wife Victoria Nuland has served in multiple Democratic administrations, including Biden's, and is definitely one of the most vocal champions for Ukraine.
The phrasing was a little bit more conspiratorial than I would necessarily be like it to be, but yeah, she's certainly been a major player in key decisions that have brought the Ukraine and Russia to where they are. Let's put it that way.
I think that is a reasonable description of reality, yes. But you could judge that however you want, but without getting too carried away with her, it's just to say that in Trump's first term, for instance, there was an incident that almost everyone has forgotten where he bombed an empty airfield in Syria, which was still ruled by Bashar Assad at the time. And this was something that, you know, during Obama's second term, the foreign policy blob, in fact, maybe it was coined around this or shortly before this, was aggressively lobbying Obama to do. Obama and Ben Rhodes basically were almost alone, even within the administration, in not wanting to do that. While, you know, you had Samantha Power and Hillary Clinton and all these people, you know, and Jeffrey Goldberg essentially lobbying hard for that, and all the neocons lobbying for an airstrike on Syria. So Trump comes in, he does it, he hits an empty airfield. I'm not sure he killed anyone. I'm not sure he damaged anything except the empty airfield. And I remember on the day that it happened, everyone like you and me and everyone with our politics was basically freaking out that Donald Trump was about to start World War III. And meanwhile, you had people like Hillary Clinton, you know, who had just been humiliatingly defeated by Trump and was constantly saying he was, you know, a dictator installed by the Russians. But she's there praising him for this exact same thing. And at the end of the day, it was like a stunt. It barely mattered. You know, it was just he did it so he could say he did it. It didn't topple Assad, although Assad was toppled years later in totally different circumstances. It didn't, you know, prevent any war crimes. The war crimes that ship had already sailed. It was totally gestural. I think he did it just to like show, you know, because Obama didn't. And at the end of the day, like everyone who was either happy or freaked out about it was being a little silly. And it's sort of weird to think back on the Obama era debate, which I think it would have been a much bigger deal if Obama had done it. And I think Obama, I mean, I was certainly on the side of him not doing it and thought it was to his credit that he didn't. There are people to this day, liberals to this day, who will disagree with that. Also in the first Trump administration, there was the killing of Soleimani. And I remember a lot of us thinking that World War III was, you know, going to start right then and there. And it didn't. It was part of a chain of events. I mean, I think that if you, like, here's the thing. Here's what I think we have to separate out right now as we look at the current moment that's in flux. We have to separate out two different kinds of problems. We can be nuanced about this. On the one hand, we're all kind of refighting the Iraq war argument forever. It was kind of a defining moment for our generation of thinkers, right? The 2002, 2003, etc. I mean, this is one reason we're also fixated on the neocons, right? Because they had a huge, insane project. They actually pulled off the, you know, getting the U.S. enmeshed in this giant war of regime change, military occupation, hundreds of thousands of boots on the ground, you know, catastrophic consequences. And there was a huge anti-war movement, and it defined Bush's presidency. It still does 20 years later. You know, that is a kind of a singular foreign policy. I mean, it's up there with Vietnam. It's like that kind of debacle, right? And then there's the more run-of-the-mill stuff that, you know, U.S. blob-driven, you know, interventionist, militarist foreign policy has been doing in some ways since the Cold War, and then in a slightly different way since the War on Terror began, which Iraq and Vietnam are actually, and I guess Korea, are kind of exceptional in terms of like getting, they're not, the U.S. has done many, many other terrible things in the last, you know, 80 years, but those are like exceptional. Most, I mean, really what makes them exceptional is the amount of American blood and treasure that's sunk into them. And that is generationally defining. Whereas what the U.S. does a lot of the time, an airstrike on Gaddafi's Libya, or a coup, or a failed coup in Venezuela, or any number of other things, it's not to defend any of that or say it doesn't have long-term catastrophic consequences, because it very often does. But it's to say that I feel like when we go into any major intervention, we go into it as if it's potentially the next Iraq. But often it's something of a much, much smaller scale and duration than that, but it can still have long-term deleterious effects. And well, I think sure, that sure, may sure, be sure. more what yeah, we're looking but, at here.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of times where, you know, America has these, like, you know, small little wars, like, you know, invading Grenada, you know, invading Panama, that don't amount to anything. But I think the, you know, larger anti-war case is you can actually never really tell like when a small war becomes a big war, right? Like,
sure,
if you get into enough small wars, you know, like one of them will actually kind of like explode in the right circumstances where you go against the wrong foe. Nobody was expecting Vietnam to be a big war. Like, they just thought it's just gonna be another like Guatemala or Iran where the U.S. will have a coup and put its people in place. I mean, I think a lot about this because I've been reading about the history of the First World War with Perry Anderson's new book, Disputing Disaster, which looks at the sort of various historical debates about it. And one of the points that Anderson and others have made is that, you know, the killing of the Archduke in 1914, nobody at the time thought this is going to lead to, you know, the greatest catastrophe in human history to date, which would like shape the rest of the century. Because there had been other previous like assassinations, both the Russians and the Austrian state had been funding all sorts of terrorist operations. There'd been a series of conflicts between the great powers over places like Morocco, you know, that would and the Balkans that would break out every few years. It just happened that, like, you know, the chain of events in that particular instance ignited the war because you already had this pre-existing system of great powers that were locked in competition against each other. This became the moment where everyone decided, you know, we're going to draw the line and then unleash the gates of hell. Now, with the Middle East, like, I think, you know, like, obviously you can, like, as Israel and the United States have done, and, you know, to be fair, as the Iranians have also done, you can have an assassination here, you can have a bombing there, it doesn't amount to much. But the worry is, like, at some point, one of these events could set off, could be the assassination of the Archduke. It could be the moment where, like, everything comes together for a much larger catastrophe.
For what it's worth, Jade, I fully agree, and I think it's the anti-war impulse. I'm not saying Trump did the right thing here, though I think it may in the short term redound politically to his benefit.
I mean, it is good that he's actually not an ideologue and he's happy with, like, getting the Fox News dopamine hit of you're the great leader. And then, you know, like,
He likes that he did it quickly. He likes there's a deal, although is there a deal? We'll see. I mean, the morning of the day we're recording this, he gave this amazing remark on the White House lawn where to reporters, first of all, where he used an F-bomb, and I'm actually struggling to remember when a sitting president has done that, and not on like an open mic by accident either, but like quite deliberately. And he seemed to blame both Israel and Iran, but if anything, he seemed more annoyed at Israel today.
Oh, you know, he actually specifically said that he's more mad at Israel than Iran.
Since Trump is unfiltered, when he says that, you know, it's probably at least at that precise moment how he feels. But as we've said, he's flaky. But what I do think is, look, I mean, there is a real catastrophe that's highly relevant to this that has been going on for the last, you know, better part of 2 years now, which is the genocide in Gaza. And although it doesn't get nearly as much press, there's a sort of slower motion ethnic cleansing happening in the West Bank as well that predated the October 7th attacks and has gotten much more accelerated since. And even just in recent months has accelerated. So, I mean, to me, that is a world historical catastrophe. It's one of the worst things that has happened in the world in our lifetime. And it's being done with the full support and backing of the US government. And when I look back on and when I look back on the catastrophic chain of decisions that got us to this point, you can see many things that we opposed along the way. For instance, Trump pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. I think there's a direct line from that to the Gaza genocide. I think there's a direct line. I think probably the Soleimani strike and just various other ways that Trump decided to reignite conflict with Iran. The move of the Abraham Accords, the movement of the embassy, like each of these things individually, people like you and I protested at the time. We were right to do so. And I think they all kind of lay the groundwork for the situation in which Hamas did what it did. And it set off the, to many of us, including me, predictable genocidal response. So we are right to fight, you know, to fight every step of U.S. militarist imperialist policy and U.S., you know, is in particular getting, you know, because you might say that includes, for instance, our supporting the sovereignty of Ukraine. And I don't want to reopen that debate, but specifically in the Mideast context, Israel basically, you know, dragging us into war after war. I mean, this is very much a war Israel dragged us into. And we're right to protest every large and small way that happens. At the same time, I think we can analytically be cognizant that I don't think this is the time when everything truly goes to hell.
No, it isn't.
There could be a time.
And honestly, I mean, it's not something people want to actually talk about. But one reason why it's not the time right now is that, you know, like over the last 2 years, and maybe more, going back to the Soleimani assassination, the Iranian state has been the grown up in the room. They have shown incredible restraint and proportionality in responding, including, like, you know, when they're bombing, as they did, American bases. They basically, as Trump acknowledged, you know, they gave America warning ahead of time that they're going to do this. But how long that lasts? I mean, like in terms of like longer term consequences, you know, we don't know what's going to happen internally within Iran. Certainly on the side of Netanyahu and his American allies, there's all these fantasies of regime change. You know, the most plausible or one very plausible scenario is that this policy of restraint actually gets rethought. And there's reports, I mean, The Economist is reporting this, that the military in Iran has getting very mad at the clerics, thinking that the clerics have been too pacific and too willing to take it in the chin. And I gotta be honest, like, if I were an Iranian citizen and I watched the events of the last few years, I would be thinking, I would be very mad at the Ayatollah and the mullahs, and not just for like all the religious repression, which I would be mad at in any case, but actually for not building a nuclear weapon. Like, I would actually think, like, I want my country to be secure, and I don't want it to be dictated by foreign powers. And, like, you know, like, we got to get nukes.
It's always dangerous, though, to put ourselves in the minds of, I mean, it's an interesting thought experiment, but I think we sometimes think, you know, if you or I were in this country, presumably we would be in the, you know, Tehran intelligentsia, and maybe we know what we think.
No, but I come from a family of cab drivers. If I was a cab driver in Tehran, I would want my country to have the bomb. And we're actually seeing this from interviews of people, you know, on the streets in Iran, where they're saying, like, you know, why don't we have the bomb?
But it's hard to know. I mean, I like to think if I were in Israel, for instance, I'd like to think that I would, you know, have many objections to Bibi Netanyahu, but maybe chief among them for, you know, clumsily letting October 7th happen. But what it seems, although he is unpopular there, it seems like what most people in Israel want is, you know, the horrific revenge against the people who carried out the attacks of October 7th. And I don't know. I don't know what people
I think it's pretty... it's more reasonable to say. I mean, I think this is like sort of an elementary point in international relations the kind of like escalation, like if you like bomb a country enough to weaken its nuclear weapon program, but not get rid of it altogether, like that actually makes nuclear proliferation more likely and not less. And the other example I would cite, which I think is a highly historically relevant one, is North Korea. That in the 1990s, Bill Clinton negotiated to bring North Korea into the nuclear nonproliferation, was getting them on a path of keeping them, you know, outside of getting nuclear power. And then when Bush came to power, both out of belligerence, general belligerence, but also insanely enough, because they wanted to include North Korea on the axis of evil, because they didn't want to just have a list of Muslim countries. See, yeah, David Trump, this is the neoconservative legacy. They broke off the nuclear negotiations, and that gave North Korea every incentive to do what actually I think was the sanest thing that their regime could have done, which is to get nuclear weapons. And more broadly, the lesson of the last few decades, if you go to, like, you look at Ukraine, You look at Libya, and you look at Iran now, and you look at North Korea. It's like, you know, if you have nukes, people don't mess with you. Basically, the larger foreign policy point is where the U.S. and Israel have created a regime, a global regime, where nuclear proliferation makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's entirely possible we will see more countries pursuing it and pursuing it more aggressively.
Yeah, I just want to add one other point, which is that if you listen to like Israeli foreign policy people like around Netanyahu, you know, they're not just threatening Iran. They have said, you know, like, well, we also have upcoming threats with Turkey and with Pakistan. If I were a foreign policy analyst in Turkey or just a man on the street in Turkey, I'd also be thinking like, you know, like, well, where's our nukes, man? Where's our nukes?
Well, I hope that's not where things are headed, but it is possible. I think that what I'm curious about is like, is there any likelihood of regime change in Iran? How badly do the U.S. or Israeli governments actually want regime change in Iran, right? I mean, regime change also, is one of the major things that distinguishes the Iraq War. It was certainly I guess you could say it was a successful war of regime change. The regime certainly did change. But in the case of Iran, I am not a particular expert in Iran. I don't know what happens if the theocracy is overthrown. I don't know who overthrows it. I don't know if the parts of the country would splinter off or try to. I don't know if there'd be a civil war. I mean, I just don't have any sense at all. I don't know, you know, how much of the public would welcome that event versus recoil from it. I don't know whether it would ultimately be in U.S. or Israeli interests or not. But these are the kind of unpredictable, you know, the consequences that could come from humiliating the mullahs one too many times, let's say.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. I will say, I mean, since neither of us are Iranian experts, I'll mention someone who's like not normally a person I would cite, but who happens to have a background in Iran, and who is a kind of interesting thinker, Sohrab Amari, who wrote like a very extensive piece, laying out the various scenarios, which include a kind of like splintering of the country. Like there are a lot of different ethnic factions. I'll mention two things. One of which is that the preferred agents of regime change of the U.S. and of Israel are two groups. One is the sort of the son of the Shah, existing monarchist faction, some of which is quite big in the exile community in like Los Angeles of all places. The other is this group, MEK, which, you know, can be described as a quite insane, formerly Marxist, formerly feminist cult. Now, neither of these groups...
Didn't Howard Dean once have some involvement with them?
Not just Howard Dean. I mean, the MEK, which had been on the State Department terrorist watch list, because they have assassinated people, they got released from that list because they successfully were able to lobby many American politicians. And I think I would encourage listeners to Google this, but the MEK... quite a few prominent American politicians of both parties have spoken at MEK events, including memorably Rudy Giuliani, who was actually recently tweeting that, no, we should not bring back the Shah. The Shah would be terrible. We need to bring back the MEK. No. I will say, like, from what I've read from people who are informed about Iran, neither of these groups has any substantial following inside Iran itself. There's no... a group of people who, no matter how much they hate the mullahs, are saying, let's bring back the Shah, or let this cult take over our country. So that in itself gives me... Now, beyond that, and I think this is actually an interesting difference between classical neoconservatism and whatever the hell it is that we have now, what might be called decadent neoconservatism, the neocons, like, of the Paul Wolfowitz variety, and I'll mention names like Arch Puddington and Joshua Moravcek, did come out of a kind of liberal Cold War social democratic tradition and did have some internationalist feelings and did actually, like, you know, were serious about nation building and regime change. They did want to try to create democracies, you know, American compliant democracies in the Middle East. Exporting Democracy by, yeah, Joshua Moravcek, which, so that was a big part of the discourse, and not just the discourse, but actual, you know, George W. Bush foreign policy, that they did take this stuff on some level of seriousness. And what the sort of paleoconservative Pat Buchanan type critique of all this was, like, you know, that's not America's job. We're not here to export democracy. That's just another form of liberalism. And, you know, that's actually a pretty cogent critique, by the way. So what I think that Trump has done is, and this is why he confuses people, you know, like, there's a kind of anti-war conservatism that is anti-war, but the more dominant strand is, just rejects nation building. Like, you know, we should intervene, quickly bomb, and get the hell out of there. It's not our job to clean up and build schools and build hospitals. It's usually summed up with the phrase, more rubble, less trouble. Let's just, like, bomb the hell out of them and get out.
I think Russell Mead once described this as the Jacksonian foreign policy, as distinct from Wilsonian, which is more neoconservative as we normally think of it, he would say it's not isolationist. It's not like we're actually walling ourselves off from the world. It's like, we don't want trouble, but if you cause trouble, if you bother us, we will bomb you, we will put you in your place, and then we'll move on. We don't have, like, a broader world conquering project than that. And I think first, Trump is a flake and Trump changes his mind all the time. But I think that is probably the closest, the most accurate way of understanding Trump's foreign policy instincts, as opposed to isolationist, neoconservative, or dovish. It's certainly not dovish. He'll happily bomb. But, you know, one reason I think it's worth noting how Iraq and Vietnam and Korea are kind of exceptional, along with the world wars, of course, what really distinguishes them is large scale presence of U.S. troops on the ground. And that is not only does that make them much more expensive, not only does that mean, you know, a lot more Americans die and a lot more American money gets spent, it also, like, makes them relevant to regular Americans' lives in a way that has, like, lasting significant political consequences, often very bad ones for the people who create those situations. Afghanistan, of course, would also fit in this, and can be grouped with Iraq. But they both come out of the 9/11 moment. But whereas, by contrast, wars we fight by proxy, wars where it's the Ukrainians doing the dying for us, or where we're arming Israel and they're doing all the fighting, or where we just, you know, do drone strikes somewhere or targeted assassination or coup somewhere, these kinds of things really don't affect the average American very much. You know, they could in unpredictable ways, as, for instance, when, you know, obviously we armed the Taliban or we armed the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union, and, you know, 15, 20 years later, there's this dramatic blowback in New York and Washington. It changes everything.
It was a memorable day.
It's a memorable day because that kind of thing doesn't happen very often. But when it does, when it does, it's a big deal. It's not to say there's no imperial blowback from all the little things we do. There's all kinds. Another example would be how our dirty wars in El Salvador have, you know, fueled refugee crises that have affected the U.S. obviously, and
increase of gangs, the gangs.
Yeah, and how we created the gangs here. I mean, there's many, many examples of how the U.S. you know, metropole is implicated in what we do abroad. You know, the state breakdown in Haiti also creates like refugee flows here. But so we could go on. There are many examples, but I don't think that I still don't think, like, you know, when you look at like what people vote on and what Americans vote on in a typical election, right? It's like the economy's up there. Certain hot button social issues will be drivers for some people. You know, it's a lot of bread and butter stuff. And then like foreign policy is usually pretty far down the list, except for instance, if there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of American troops on the ground and they're getting shot at every day, or there's a draft, in which case it's a totally different scenario. So this is all to say, I actually think people like I've written pieces to the effect that like we've learned nothing from 9/11 and the war on terror. I wrote that after October 7th. But I actually do think some lessons do get learned. Sometimes they later get unlearned. You know, after Vietnam, it took until the Gulf War, basically. So it took about 15 years or so before anyone. I mean, there were plenty of international crises, and the Cold War was going on in the meantime. And you had a belligerent Reagan, but there was a reticence to deploy large numbers of U.S. troops. And then, of course, because it went as well as it did in the Persian Gulf War and in the Balkans, there was this sense of invincibility from the neocons and the liberal hawks that got us into Iraq and Afghanistan after 9/11. But, you know, I think the lesson that Obama took, that Biden took actually earlier in some ways with his not wanting us to get deeper into Afghanistan and with his actually pulling us out, that Trump to a certain extent, I think, has taken. And don't laugh at me, that even I think the Bush administration in the wake of its own disasters had taken by its final years. For instance, you're, I'm sure, familiar with the story where Norman Podhoretz, an aging Norman Podhoretz, goes to visit the White House and meets Bush and Rove. I think he's like getting an award or something.
The Medal of Freedom. Yeah.
Yeah. He's the Medal of Freedom. It's like 2006 or seven. And he's like, Mr. President, you have to bomb Iran. Like, you have to like to take the World War IV to Iran or whatever. And I think Bush and Rove just kind of like scoffed at him afterwards, because from their point of view, it was like, no, man, we have enough going on with this disasters we've already started. Like, we're not starting a new one. And there were a lot of neocons who wanted that. Cheney may have even wanted that, but they didn't. It's all to say, like, American presidents understand, in both parties, understand perfectly well it's enormous risk with enormous downside potential for them politically to put large numbers of troops in harm's way. Now, where I think the anti-war movement over a few generations now sometimes gets confused is in our sweeping holistic attacks on America's biggest foreign policy disasters, we conflate our correct judgment that these are, you know, monstrous imperial crimes that kill millions of people abroad with the, you know, political reality that they are unpopular when the American people see large numbers of American troops bleeding for years. But it doesn't mean that the American people have accepted the first judgment, even if it's correct. They may not care at all. And my impression is that the American people have a very, very high tolerance for killing foreigners abroad. They have a very low tolerance for Americans dying abroad. And this shapes anti-war politics in profound ways.
Yeah, I want to like take issue with that just a little bit, because I was talking last week with Matt Dawson and we went over some of this stuff and just present a sort of counterpoint. First of all, one is that this like current attack on Iran is not popular. Like, but the poll I saw this morning was
56%. And to be fair, neither is Donald Trump. It should be said.
Neither is Donald Trump. But this is like less. The attack is less popular than even Trump. So which it seems to indicate that there are people who like otherwise like Trump, but don't like the attack. But more broadly, now it's obviously the case that, you know, like if you have, you know, like tens of thousands of people dying during Vietnam or thousands dying as during the first Iraq War, you know, the war looms very large. But I think one point that the Matt Duss made to me, which struck with me, is that, like, you know, since the end of the Cold War, The candidate that, you know, offers a more pacific foreign policy or talks more in the anti-war vein is the one that has won in every election except for 2004, which was a 9/11 election. Now, and that it's not an accident. And I don't think that one can, like, write off the fact that Trump was able to rise to prominence in part because he attacked the Iraq war and was the only Republican who was willing to do so, like, on stage in 2015. And that set him apart because there was a lot of Americans who had been came to the conclusion by that point that this war was a disaster and they were weary of the war. But more importantly, and beyond that, like, there's actually some really good social science looking at how Trump won in the Midwest and the sort of Pennsylvania. And in places where there was like a heavy deployment and heavy loss of troops, rural areas, he overperformed. As against places where there had been less deployment, and that seems to, and no, Trump in 2016 specifically ran, we wouldn't say like anti-war, but it is a more like isolation, like more reluctant, more prudent, as he did in 2024. And beyond that, I think that the if there's chaos in the world, if foreign policy is dominating the headlines, and there's like killings in Ukraine and in Gaza, that gives a lot of people the sense that, you know, like things are getting out of control. And Trump played to that with the, you know, like in 2024 by, you know, World War III, these guys are going to lead us into World War III. And with the Ukraine stuff in particular, like, I don't think one can disentangle Ukraine from things like the cost of living crisis. You know, the Ukraine war pretty specifically led to, like, you know, cost food prices rising and things like copper metal. So I do actually think that, like, you know, like, would I say it's a decisive thing or it's the only thing? No. But, like, the actual, there's an enormous war weariness in America, an enormous feeling that, you know, when they don't, this is a country that does not want to get involved with these chaotic wars and be a source for chaos itself. And I think that
take all of your and our friend Matt's points. I think these are all good and valid points. All I'm trying to say is what I said earlier, that I think the tolerance specifically for foreign deaths is higher, and that the specific things that the median American is concerned with when they are anti-war are largely how it affects America. So to the extent that it causes food prices to go up, which in the case of the Ukraine war is true, you're right. To the extent that, let's say, if a war is very expensive and meanwhile people are unhappy about the economy, and you can make the case it's too much guns, not enough butter, which I think, for instance, Bill Clinton ran on in 92, you know, in the wake of the Persian Gulf War, I think that's right. Peace dividend. I think Americans care about America, by and large, which is one reason why Trump's America First pitch is so compelling. And as such, I don't think that people are upset because some Iranians might die if we bomb Iran. I think people are upset because, first of all, they have more pressing problems they wish that the government paid attention to instead. Second, they may think, and not unreasonably, even if it turns out not to be true in this particular case, that this is going to lead to a chain of events that ends up with American troops being deployed abroad. And that would be, they certainly wouldn't want that. They also might think it could cause oil prices to spike, which would be a very legitimate concern that would affect American day-to-day life.
Not to worry. Trump has posted on Truth Social, you know, don't raise those oil prices.
Well, the fact that he's posting it tells you that this is very much on his mind and the minds of his administration, because that would have real political effects. But, you know, I mean, my metaphor for this, I guess, would be, you know, in D.C. where I grew up, there's famously on the Mall, there's the Vietnam War Memorial, right? This kind of black gash in the earth. And it was a controversial memorial when it was built, because it controversial with, you know, patriotic or right leaning Americans, because it you know, paints an American war as a tragedy. But if you actually go and look at it, the tragedy is, you know, I think 65,000 American names on the wall. The tragedy is not the millions of Vietnamese who died. That is not what America is commemorating there. They're commemorating how many Americans died in the war. And that's not to say there aren't many Americans who don't also feel that it was a crime against the Vietnamese. There were obviously many who went out to protest on that basis. But I do think the lesson from Vietnam is we can't have a draft. I think that's the lasting political lesson that everyone took. And the lesson from the lesson from the post 9/11 wars, the two big ones, Iraq and Afghanistan, is basically don't do a full scale American occupation of a large country. It's going to be a quagmire. But the lesson is not so. I think, for instance, Obama took that lesson to heart. But well, sort of, except where he got rolled into surging in Afghanistan, which even at the time I think he knew was a bad idea, and which Biden advised him against. But what Obama did do. And I'm not defending what Obama did, but I do think that anti-war critics have to understand why it was different in his conception of the politics, was this expanded drone war. And I think his view was, well, no Americans are at risk here. It's targeted killings. Yes, some civilians will die, but most Americans don't care about that. It shows that I'm being tough in the war on terror. I can do that in a politically sustainable way. And, coldly, I don't think there's any reason to think that was a bad political calculation on his part. It might be a bad moral calculation. There might be long-term blowback consequences we don't anticipate. But I don't think that, it should be totally politically intelligible why Barack Obama, who is not a stupid person, would think this is going to work for me politically, and give me cover in the war on terror, which I need to do, which is still a high salience issue when he's president, in a way that, getting into another Iraq-type situation would not be. I think that was a comprehensible calculation.
Sure. I think within the narrow confines of the sort of two-party system, but even within that, I mean, if you actually listen to people I think it's very important to actually listen to people like Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson, and who they obviously had lost the fight over bombing Iran or whatever, but they are a faction.
I do listen to them, but I should say a lot of what they say horrifies me.
Sure.
And is a part of a holistic worldview, but
the critique that they had, and the critique that I think actually is partially responsible for the fact that they were able to win over a lot of anti-system Americans, a lot of young people, a lot of people of color that would not otherwise have voted for another Republican. The critique that they had was that we are committed to these wars of regime change and this constant interventionism, and that this is does not serve American interests and is going to cause problems for us in the world, right? And I think that whether it's a majority coalition or in America, in politics, it's all about margins, right? If you can get enough people to think this way and are willing to switch parties, or I think more likely to sit out elections, I think that a lot of this anti-war talk by Donald Trump was designed to discourage Hillary Clinton voters and to discourage Kamala Harris voters. And by the polling, it seems to have worked. I do actually think that even the drone wars and the national security stuff that is more palatable to a majority, it is alienating. And I think that there are political consequences of, but it, even beyond and more importantly, the actual national security consequences and the actual consequences for America's ability to live safely in the world are still crucial. So I don't think it can be so easily discounted, even if one makes allowances. I actually think it's perfectly rational for Americans to care more about Americans dying than otherwise. I mean, I think nationalism is a healthy kind of instinct. I mean, I would be more concerned if Canadians are sent off to die in war than I would be if it's
speaking of this kind of Iran thing has been a giant distraction from the looming war between our nations, Chief.
I think it's good. I mean, you guys let Americans die in Iran, not in Montreal and Toronto.
When are we going for Greenland? We've totally dropped the ball on that.
That's right.
We dropped the ball on a lot of stuff.
Well, I actually thought the the Green Line would be that sort of splendid little war that Trump wanted, but he got distracted by Iran. But perhaps on that note, I mean, there's a lot more to say, but I think we've taken up our time. So I want to thank David once again for being on the program.
Always a pleasure. And I hope when we listen to this recording and whoever's listening to it, I hope that the news about Zoran Mamdani is good.
Yeah. Well,
in a few hours, we'll see.
We'll see, yes.
Yeah.
I have my fingers crossed as well.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. Sally from Finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.